Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Myelin Institute podcast with me, Tim Bale, Professor of Politics here at Queen Mary University of London and the Myelin Institute. Today, I'm delighted to welcome the Deputy Director of the prestigious Institute for Government, Hannah White, who's just published a fantastic book called Held in Contempt, which asks what's wrong with the House of Commons and what we can do about it. The book's a fairly brief, approachably written book and contains a really good mix of analysis, anecdote and reflections, both from people Hannah has spoken to and from Hannah herself as someone who used to work in the Commons. In short, it's a really good guide to the pressing issues by someone who really knows what they're talking about. Indeed, on that score, some of you may already know Hannah from her myriad appearances in the media, so we're doubly pleased that she could find time in her crowded schedule to come and chat to us here at MEI. So, Hannah, welcome. First question, before we get into some of the nitty-gritty in your book, what led you to write it in the first place?
Well, thanks very much for that very kind introduction, Tim. It's great to be here today. I guess it really was a mounting sense of frustration. I've worked in and around Whitehall and Westminster, as you say, for nearly two decades now, and I just got really sick of hearing people bemoan the fact that trust in politics is really low, but sort of have this implied sense of helplessness that there was just nothing that could be done about it. And I started to think, well, you know, I just don't think that's true. There are things that I can see about Westminster which could operate a whole lot better. And actually, it's the responsibility of people who work there and people who work around it, like me, to say so and to actually do some stuff about it rather than to just sort of act as if it's a natural state of being for people not to trust politicians.
Okay. So, I mean, you don't pull your punches about those politicians or indeed prime ministers in the book. I mean, apart from the more kind of abstruse procedural strokes they pull in the House of Commons itself, you also single out their more general, what I'd call Parliament versus the people rhetoric. Why do you think that rhetoric matters as much as some of the, you know, more instrumental procedural stuff?
So, I mean, I was really struck by this during Brexit, and it's not as though it was a new thing in that, you know, parliamentarians are often sort of accused by the government of interfering unnecessarily, and there's often an implication for ministers that they see Parliament as a sort of unnecessary just a hurdle that they have to jump over in order to get their policies through. But what I felt was really damaging during the Brexit period was the sort of implication from the government, both in what they said and in the way they behaved, and this was both the May government and the Johnson government, that it really didn't matter what Parliament thought, because they had this separate sense of legitimacy and authority from the outcome of the referendum. And Parliament essentially ought to just butt out and let the ministers decide how to give effect to the outcome of that referendum. And I really felt that actually the constructive role that Parliament can play in giving sort of in the implementation of a decision that has been taken, whether by ministers or by referendum or in whatever way, was just completely disregarded. And in fact, as you say, there was a narrative to say, well, actually, Parliament is against the people, and is trying to do something against what the public want, rather than playing its normal role, as I believe it should have been allowed to do more fully, in getting all the complicated issues around Brexit discussed and thinking how best to give effect to that decision.
And I mean, at the time of the COVID crisis, we saw to some extent, especially early on, Parliament almost in abeyance and replaced by those daily press conferences. I mean, what would you say to someone who said, well, actually, you know, journalists asking awkward gotcha questions of the politicians are more likely to be able to hold them to account than politicians in Parliament. You know, more people are watching, and in some ways, those journalists have got less of a vested interest in giving their targets, as it were, an easy ride.
Yeah, I just don't think that that really washes as an argument. If you listen to those press conferences, I mean, I'm not actually disputing that the press conferences were a really important way for politicians to communicate their messages to the public. But I also think ministers being held in to account in Parliament is a completely different thing. And, you know, that yes, you know, journalists can ask the gotcha question and they can get the soundbite that ends up on the 10 o'clock news. But actually what politicians can do, what MPs can do in the House of Commons chamber is actually ask the detailed questions which come from their constituents. So, you know, they all MPs had an enormous increase in constituency correspondence and business that they had to deal with during the pandemic, because they had hundreds of thousands of constituents who were dealing with really tricky, difficult issues. And the government was constantly legislating, amending its legislation. The rules to which everyone was subject were constantly changing. And that was really difficult for people to navigate. And MPs had lots of questions that needed to be asked in order to help everyone understand and clarify the rules, which were being made up as they went along, as the scientific advice developed and in an inevitable way. But I think that, you know, just asking the one question in a press conference is a completely different thing to what MPs are able to do when they have a minister in front of them and drill down into the issues and raise the questions that their constituents are asking.
And I mean, the effect of both the pandemic and indeed of Brexit, not least the TCA, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, has been to transfer power from Parliament to government. And as I said, COVID probably did the same. You know, we talk and you talk in your book about fast tracking and skeleton bills. Could you briefly explain terms like that for listeners and then maybe suggest why we should think, particularly in the case of the latter, these skeleton bills, that the exceptional, you know, might well become the norm?
Yeah, so I mean, and again, these things really accelerated during Brexit and COVID, but they weren't totally new with Brexit and COVID. And there was already, I think, a trend of governments trying to essentially find easier ways to get their legislation through the House of Commons. So there were various sort of normal procedures for passing bills through Parliament, which involve various stages, which normally would take place over a period of weeks and months, over a parliamentary session, which lasts a year. But for very good reasons, there are procedures which allow you to expedite that process so that you can, when you need to legislate quickly, as obviously the government did need to do with the pandemic, then you can ask parliamentarians to go through all the stages much more quickly. And in fact, the TCA, which you mentioned, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement, in the end went through both houses and received royal assent from the Queen in a single day. So that's how fast you can do it if you really want to. That is something which we've seen government doing, not necessarily that fast, but using processes to enable it to legislate more quickly, using those more often. And that's something that's been a subject of real concern within Parliament. And then the other issue which you raise is this idea of skeleton bills. And these are pieces of legislation which, rather than having lots of policy detail in the content of the bill, policy detail which parliamentarians might be able to sort of pick apart and ask questions about as the bill proceeds through Parliament, instead of having that detail, what the bill does is just ask Parliament to give ministers the power to make what's called secondary legislation. So these are regulations, lower category, if you like, of legislation which can be made by government and just gets signed off by Parliament in a much less rigorous process of scrutiny. And rather than have the policy in the bill, ministers say to Parliament, please just give us the power to pass secondary legislation to fill in all the detail afterwards, because we haven't got time to do it all now. And that means that essentially Parliament is giving away a lot of its power to ministers, who subsequently can fill in all this detail on things which can actually be really significant in the end, but parliamentarians only get a very minimal say over those regulations when those go through Parliament.
Okay, and I mean, should we worry that that is going to become more common, do you think? Or do you think it was just, you know, a symptom of a couple of episodes, Brexit and COVID, which are exceptional and probably will begin to move away from that kind of thing as we move away, hopefully, from both of those?
Well, as I say, they were justified to some extent during those two crises. I think that I am worried that certain habits have been formed in government, that actually having the powers to legislate rather than having to spend hours in Parliament going through all the detail in lots of committees and so on, it's much more convenient to ministers. Ministers who've been in their roles during the pandemic, during Brexit, have got used to being able to pass skeleton bills. It's also convenient for ministers because, to be honest, we all know that sometimes legislation is passed just so that ministers can say they're doing something. It's sort of declaratory, you know, this is very important and therefore what we are doing is passing a bill. And if you don't have to take the time to work out what the content of that bill is going to be in any detail before you can introduce it, it's a very useful tool to be able to say to people, oh, look, well, you know, we've done something. So I do worry that ministers are getting used to having this tool at their disposal, passing these skeleton bills. And that means that actually ministers are not having to come to the Parliament and explain their policies and justify why they think it's necessary to legislate. Because we legislate a lot in this country and, you know, arguably some of it's not all necessary.
That's interesting. Now, the two of the big themes in the book are executive dominance and the increase thereof and declining public trust in Parliament and even parliamentary democracy. What do you think is the causal link between the two? Because it seems to me in the book that you are suggesting that somehow executive dominance on the one hand and then the decline in trust in the Parliament on the part of the public are linked. What's the link?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is this sort of declining sense of trust, which is in the, if you look in the data, there is a declining sense of trust in Parliament. And I think that is linked to the way that the executive treats Parliament and the way that the executive is able to treat Parliament because of the exceptional amount of control that governments have in the UK over the agenda of what happens in the House. So the government gets to decide what happens in the House of Commons. Largely, there are a few days set aside for opposition or backbench business, but the government can even decide when those happen. And I think that this degree of control does a number of things. It stops parliamentarians being able to sort of improve their own institution to an extent because there are various committees in the House of Commons whose job it is to come up with ways of doing things better. We've got the Procedure Committee, which looks at the Commons procedures. We've got the Liaison Committee that looks at how select committees work, among other things. They can come up with as many good ideas as they like about how Parliament could run better and could be more effective for the people. But unless government thinks it's in its interests to allow those good ideas to be discussed and potentially implemented, it just doesn't have to provide any time for those things to be on the agenda. So we've got, you know, for example, Procedure Committee has long had suggestions about how the private members bill process could work better, but those have never been debated or decided on because it wouldn't be in the interest of the government to change that procedure. Mm-hmm. And I think that you could do a lot in the same way that in recent years people have thought about ways to make the public petition system work better in the House of Commons, petition system being sort of relatively low threat to the government so that they let that reform happen. But I think you could do a lot to improve public trust in and value, you know, the extent to which the public value Parliament by reforming the private members bill system, the system by which backbenchers can legislate. If those bills which came through were really seen to be, you know, important with cross-party support, well argued, rather than just the relatively random ones which come through at the moment, then I think that would be really good for public trust in Parliament. So that's just an example of how, because the government has so much control, there are things which can't happen and can't improve about Parliament because it's not in their interest to allow it to happen.
Do you think, though, that Parliament has actually got any weaker, because the UK, in some ways, relatively speaking, to compared to other legislatures, has always been quite weak, hasn't it? Do you think the situation has got any worse?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that the situation with Brexit, where government was actively arguing that the Parliament shouldn't have a role and seeking to sideline Parliament was really damaging. I think there are wider trends whereby Parliament has inevitably just less of a role. We've seen it with the growth of secondary legislation, which we've been talking about, that more stuff is being done. The state is getting more complicated in general, and many of the things which are being done, under the auspices of the state, are being done with secondary legislation, which Parliament has relatively little say over. And that is a matter of executive choice, right? They could do it, using primary legislation and having more of those, that more parliamentary input, but they're deciding not to because, largely speaking, it's easier not to.
One thing I wondered as I was reading the book as well was, how much do you think that partisanship is at the root of so many of the problems that you discuss, the inability of MPs to act in the interests of democracy and defend the legislature against the executive, being rooted in the fact that their main incentive is always party advantage, whichever side they're on?
Yeah, I think that is definitely true. And one of the things that, I don't do so much in the book is look at the whole role of political parties, which is obviously key to how the whole of Parliament works. It's, as you say, a short book, and I wanted to focus on the sort of the parliamentary aspects. But I think it is definitely the case that, my argument is that MPs ought to pay more attention to the reputation of Parliament and its credibility. But asking them to do that means asking them, they have so many priorities. They have to think about, their party priorities, their constituency, their personal priorities. Asking them to also think about the Parliament as an institution is a big ask. But I also think that it's essential, because at the end of the day, unless Parliament has credibility for doing a decent, useful job within a democratic system, they won't have any authority as MPs sitting in that Parliament. So I do think partisanship is a problem which gets in the way of people thinking about Parliament and its value. That's to an extent why I argue that there needs to be a bit more involvement and forcing MPs to think about the long-term interests of the institution, and maybe involving the public more in some of those decisions that get made, having maybe more lay members on committees, for example, whose job it would be to say to the current crop of MPs, this isn't just all about you today. What about the interests of this institution, which is, on at the end of the day, working on behalf of the public in the future?
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting suggestion, although, of course, partisanship doesn't just affect MPs. I guess it also affects members of the public. We seem to have some people in the electorate who would be prepared to put up with almost anything as long as it continues government that they're supportive of. But anyway, why, when it comes to public trust in Parliament, don't you think that ultimately some of the kind of outreach efforts and political education that Parliament has begun to turn to in the last decade or so will make much difference? I'm not saying that you're totally sceptical about those efforts, but you're not as perhaps persuaded as some people who pursue those efforts would perhaps like you to be.
I mean, I'm not totally sceptical, and I do think that, there's been a real step change in Parliament's efforts to communicate what it does to the public. What I don't think that achieves, though, is a genuine sense for the public that that Parliament is really interested in the reciprocal side of that and public input into Parliament. So we've had some examples. We had the Climate Assembly, for example, which was commissioned by six select committees, and the Citizens Assembly looking at adaptation to climate change, and those select committees, I think, are making some use of the outcome of that process in their work that they've done since. But I think, to an extent, that engagement work can be you know, trying to explain a very complicated institution to the public when for many members of the public, it's very far from their, you know, primary concern to understand what's going on in Parliament. And I think there needs to be more efforts made within Parliament to sort of simplify and explain what it is that Parliament's doing. I think the language is unnecessarily complicated and some of the procedures are unnecessarily complicated. So when there are important things going on in Parliament and, you know, really big issues, too often what's happening in the media is a discussion of what on earth is going on in Parliament in a procedural sense, rather than what is the significance and the importance of the issue that Parliament is dealing with.
Mm. And actually, your book does go into the sheer complexity that MPs themselves face when they're trying to understand procedure and try and get a grip on the rules that, you know, some senses go back centuries in order to be able to challenge the government and scrutinise the government. I mean, how much do you think does need to change in that respect? And what are the prospects for that change? You know, one of the things, obviously, you've already said is that, you know, MPs are more reluctant than perhaps they should be to make changes, even where, you know, they might be in their interest to do so.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a real problem. And I think that sometimes people inside Parliament, they like the complexity. They like the fact that they understand the complexity. And it's almost like a game. That if you can find the most arcane rule which enables you to score a point, then, you know, then you've won in the game. And I just think the effort that goes into working out how to win the game as opposed to actually engaging on the issues is wrong. You know, you ask what are the prospects of changing this. I mean, there have been efforts to try to simplify what are called standing orders, the sort of the basic set of rules, although there are many other sort of different sources of rules that sit around the standing orders. But those haven't really gone anywhere. There have been some efforts to help explain procedure in sort of plain English to MPs, because it was recognised by the staff of the House that lots of MPs just didn't even understand the rules that they were supposed to be, you know, playing by. And that, I think, has been helpful. You don't have to buy the enormous scholarly tome of Erskine May in order to...
As you point out, you can download it now anyway.
You can download it now. When I was involved in the editing of the last edition, I unsuccessfully argued to the then editor that it ought to be online. But my successors have been more successful and have got it online. So, yes, and you know, so I think that... it is a problem there, and what I argue in the book is that there ought to be a kind of rolling program of reviewing parliamentary language and parliamentary rules and suggesting ways to simplify it, make it more accessible, so that at the end of the day we're not talking about what the rules are, we're talking about you know, the rules are doing their job and providing a level playing field for everyone and enabling the business of Parliament to get done.
Now, I mean, you worked in Parliament, and obviously we at Queen Mary, we send students on placements there, so we've got a fair idea of what it's like from the ground up. I mean, why is it, and it's something you deal with really brilliantly in the book, that MPs think they're so special? what are some of the consequences of that you go into in the book?
Yeah, so I have a whole chapter. You might think this is a bit of a bugbear of mine. Whole chapter. About this sort of exceptionalism of MPs, which we've had brilliantly illustrated through the whole Partygate scandal, this sense that MPs have that, you know, there's one rule for them and one for everyone else. And I look in the book at some of the reasons I think that sort of develops. And there are really good reasons why MPs are special and have to have rights and privileges that enable them to do their jobs. But I think, unfortunately, there's a combination of the sort of psychology of the sort of person who tends to become an MP, combined with some of those legitimate reasons that they're special, can give some of them who are inclined to it too much of a sense that actually no rules apply to them, or none of the rules that, you know, they want to have to adhere to. And I think that that is a big problem, because it creates this sense of hypocrisy for the public, that they're being asked to do things that actually MPs aren't bothering to do. And it undermines the legitimacy of that role of Parliament, which is to set the rules. So I think it's really important for MPs to reflect on the limits to their specialness, and actually to flip it around and think, well, you know, we shouldn't just be an exception to all the rules. What we want to be is an exemplar. We want to show that in Parliament we have the highest standards of financial probity, the highest standards of HR, and we're doing everything, you know, when there's an exceptional period like COVID, for example, you know, we are absolutely following the rules, because how can we expect anyone else to do that unless we do it ourselves?
One of the many anomalies in Parliament is the employment situation, in which staff find themselves, and to some extent MPs find themselves as well. MPs are not employees themselves, but they are employers. Why do you think this makes it especially difficult for staff working for Parliament to have the kind of normal workplace protections that other people have a right to expect in the 21st century?
Yeah, this has been a real problem. And there's also the kind of constitutional status of an MP that, you know, they're in Parliament because they have been elected by the people. And so you can't sort of discipline them in the same way that you might if you had someone who was directly employed on a contract. They don't have that sort of contract basis for the doing the job. That means that there has to be, you know, a system which, if they do something which is not allowed under the rules, they have to end up being judged by their peers. If it's a sort of a case of, you know, should they be suspended from the House or anything, you know, or beyond that, excluded from the House, anything which would deprive their constituents of that MP's services, as it were, can't just be decided by a sort of independent process. In the end, it has to come back to MPs themselves. And as we've already discussed, and as we saw with the Owen Paterson scandal last year, that always involves, you know, inevitably there's a degree of partisanship when MPs are deciding on their own. So for staff who are employed by MPs, this makes things very difficult, because they don't have this sort of external authority that they can appeal to. If something is done to them in a context of an employment situation, their MP is the person who's both potentially the person who's done that thing and the person to whom they would need to complain. So a lot of work has gone on in very recent years trying to think about providing mechanisms within the House of Commons for people to be able to report bullying or harassment. The parties, I think, have thought about this a bit, although I've not heard any sort of ringing endorsement of the processes having been improved within the parties on this. But I think what we've seen in recent weeks is that although there's some process that's been put in place, actually the culture which needs to sort of follow behind that in order for MPs to accept this fact that actually if they're employers, they have certain responsibilities towards their staff, and towards each other, indeed, that culture still hasn't really come on the journey that we need it to.
Mm. And I just wondered, actually, as an aside, what you thought about the issue of maternity leave in the Commons, because we've had recently confirmation that the cabinet ministers can take maternity leave, at least from their cabinet posts, but MPs effectively aren't allowed to, as Stella Creasy found. They can't get, as it were, someone to come in and act for them as an MP while they go off. Is there any solution to that?
So other parliaments do have a solution to that, but they don't tend to be first past the post type parliaments. Yeah. So parliaments with a list system can work a system where they have a sort of alternate for the MP who can come in and, you know, work in circumstances where they're unable to, including maternity leave. I think that if we want to have a representative parliament with all sorts of different experiences in life, including the experiences of parents represented, we need to do more to make sure that the parliamentarians can find a way of having maternity leave. Now, obviously, Stella Creasy, as you mentioned, she's been able to get some support with her constituency work. But the thing that she's really battled for is to be able to have someone who can come in and do some of her parliamentary work. There's been a very firm line held that actually that is deemed to be constitutionally inappropriate because that person who was coming in wouldn't be the person that her constituents had voted for. But I think that, you know, if it was clearly established that in these circumstances, which after all are relatively unusual, that this would be the arrangement, and at the end of the day, the accountable person would still have to be the MP themselves for things that were done. Everything short, I think, of voting on legislation and so on in Parliament, I think could be done by somebody else for a limited period. I think I think the benefit of doing that would outweigh the risks that certain people see.
Okay. And one of the most, you know, fascinating parts of the book is when you take a look at the actual physical structure of Parliament. Fascinating, but also very worrying, particularly if you're not keen on mice or falling masonry or the possibility of an electrical fire, etc. And yet, in some ways, you point to this and say, well, maybe it will take, you know, some awful crisis to occur for reform to be made. I mean, that actually is quite a striking argument to make. Do you really think the situation is that bad that we will, you know, need a really fundamental crisis to blow up, possibly literally, in order for this institution to be reformed?
Well, obviously, I don't hope that there will actually be a crisis, in the sense that, you know, and regrettably, I sort of, certainly on the building itself, I don't think that MPs will ever face up to the need to get serious work done on the parts of Westminster until somebody is hurt. And I regret that fact. But, you know, at some stage, a piece of masonry is going to drop on someone's head, or there is going to be a fire like in Notre Dame Cathedral. And then at short notice, everyone will be forced to decant out of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, which is the thing that MPs and, well, actually MPs have resisted. Peers have been much more pro the idea in a regretful way. So I do think that the work on the palace will never happen until there's a crisis that forces it. In terms of our politics more generally, I mean, in a way, it was a slightly flippant way to end the book, but I do think it is true that it is only when there is a crisis of some sort that you see significant change in Parliament. And in some ways, it's no different to any large, complex organisation in that. But it does have some particular features which make that even more of a problem in Parliament, I think. The fact that there is no one person who can speak for Parliament and make decisions on its behalf, and that any decision made by any Parliament cannot bind its successors. So as we've seen with the restoration and renewal of the palace, decisions made a few years back in order to handle the restoration one way are just, you know, being unpicked by the current Parliament. So I, you know, there are some particular problems in Parliament, and we've seen in the past, it's only when you have a crisis that you see significant change.
Well, that brings us very nearly to the end of the podcast. I should say we haven't been able to cover everything in this really great little book. There's a lot in there as well if you're interested in improving the diversity of Parliament and making it look and sound a little bit more like the country that MPs claim to represent. There are an awful lot of recommendations in there as well. So I would certainly I suggest anyone who's interested in the future of British politics and in the Houses of Parliament in particular to take a look at Hannah's book. It really remains for me to thank you, Hannah, for turning up and talking a little bit about that book. Good luck with it. Good luck with some of the recommendations. It left me feeling, in a way, slightly sceptical as to how many of them will be taken on board and implemented. But, you know, fingers crossed, some of them will. Some of them are very practical recommendations that could actually be implemented in fairly short order. But anyway, I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, everybody. If you have, please do share and do recommend the podcast to other people. You can find out more about the Mile End Institute by going to our website. We're also on Twitter and other social media platforms. Until the next episode, goodbye.